With the publication of her best-selling books Inside of a Dog and Being a Dog, Alexandra Horowitz established herself as the foremost authority on dog behavior and offered owners new insights into the lives of their beloved pets. Now Horowitz turns her observant eye and incomparable wit to the owners themselves and our dogs, ourselves, the story of a singular bond, an exploration of the relationship between dogs and humans and how that relationship affects both species. From what we name them to how we talk to them to the essential question of whether or not our dogs love us too. Senior research fellow Alexandra Horowitz heads the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College and is the author of the new book, Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Alexandra to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me.
I always enjoy your work, and I always enjoy talking to you. So what brought you to want to look at our part in this equation?
Right. The human has not been the subject of my gaze as much as a scientist. I always am looking at the dog, but I look at and study owned dogs. So when these dogs come into my lab to participate in a study, they're coming with their person, they're coming with their owner. And at some level, this human-dog relationship, I realized, was the elephant in the room. There was a lot going on between them, as we all know, as I know from living with dogs myself, that itself is fascinating and worth bringing a little attention to, and hence this book.
How much are they a reflection of us?
Well, I think we very much see them as a reflection of us. We want dogs to reflect us. They embody a lot of the qualities we admire, right? Sort of continual cheeriness, loyalty, maybe to a fault. At some level, we like that they will stay quiet, you know, will listen to us, seem to be attuned to our emotions. So they, in many ways, reflect our ideal selves.
But how much do they really reflect us? In the sense of, if I'm neurotic, will the dog be neurotic?
I think there is certainly the argument to be made that there is a kind of contagious personality between dog and person, and that's partly because we choose dogs who we think match us in some ways, and not just in temperament, but also at some level in appearance. I'm not saying that people look identical to their pups, but there has been research showing that subjects can match pictures of humans and pictures of dogs and see who owns who. And that's because I think we kind of, you know, find the dog that seems energetic if you're energetic, or you know, seems proud if you feel proud. So there's a way we look for dogs that match what we think we look like.
You have many, you answer so many questions in here, and you have different things. Sections of the book is the trouble with breeds, and that just brings up a general question for you: is how different, when we talk about dogs and you write a book about dogs inside of a dog, how much of that is different in talking about a Maltese than it is when you're talking about a Saint Bernard?
It's a great question. You know, when I study dogs, I'm studying just the general Platonic dog. But there really is no such thing. Breeds do act very differently, as we know. That's why people appreciate different breeds. They have tendencies and predispositions that lead to different behaviors and different responses and kind of different rates of living. Once we get the first round of research showing generally what dogs, you know, see, smell, and know, what they can detect about the world through their nose and what they understand, then we can go dive in and say, well, actually, are there any breed-specific differences? And sometimes there are.
You have a section in the book called The Scientific Process as Practiced at Home Watching Dogs on a Thursday Evening. So the scientific, you have these, you will state a hypothesis, and then you will give us information on that hypothesis and then revise it and keep revising it until a conclusion is made. So the questions there are things like of dogs liking their toys. Is a dog man's best friend? Do they know their size? Do they speak to us? Do they have their own language? These are the things that we really want to know, isn't it?
I think most people who live with dogs have questions like this, right? And they kind of, just like me living with my dogs, you know, they sort of float by our heads in the evenings while we're hanging out and maybe hanging out with our pups. And I wanted to, in this chapter, kind of bring a tongue-in-cheek look at how the scientific process can be brought to those just natural reflections that we have when we turn our gaze to our dogs.
What does personality, I guess, does personality get into it? Like, let's talk about the question that I just raised about, do dogs know their size? So now I own a 120-pound yellow lab. Now, does he know he's a chuckle-headed monster, and I ask the question because he just walks on my face like he doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I think you let him do that at some level, right? I mean, they like to be
close. Oh, guilty as charged. Guilty as charged.
So there's no bad ramification for doing some of these things. I mean, when I have watched dogs interact with other dogs, I get a very strong impression that they do know their size, right? So large dogs and small dogs can play together quite well. Large dogs will self-handicap, is what it's called. They'll moderate the force of their bite or their jump onto another dog if it's a smaller dog. You know, they behave differently. So they seem to understand that, you know, their bodies with respect to others. Now, puppies are off limits, right? They're learning.
Right.
They bang into things. They jump up on things. But and then as a dog gets older, you know, if your dog still sits on your lap, say, when they're a giant dog, it's because you let them sit on your lap, you know, but
yes,
not necessarily because they think, I might fit here.
That's something that I have allowed. And that brings us to the point of we have a large responsibility here, right? I mean, some of this is the dog, but a lot of this is us.
This is
getting back to the original point that we're a large part of this equation.
Absolutely is an interesting way to get back to that point that, you know, we are responsible for bringing this species, dogs, into existence. And we have made what was a resourceful wild animal into an animal dependent on us. And there are ways when you probe the relationship, which I think we could be more responsible to them for the fact that we've brought them into our fold and we enjoy their company.
Oh, now I find that fascinating. So how can we be more responsible?
Well, I think there are a lot of interesting parts of the relationship which we haven't examined. You know, so dogs are, for instance, although we consider them members of our family,
yes,
most of us, they're also, to the law, they're personal property, right? So their value is just exactly what we paid for them and nothing more. Not if you've lived with them for 17 years and they've been to all your family events and your children grew up with them, they're still worth the $100 that you paid to the shelter or whatever you paid to a breeder. So if that's the case, then the law allows us to do a lot of the things with this personal property that seem kind of at dissonance with the feeling that they're part of our family. For instance, you know, you can give them up at any time, which you can't do with your children, no matter how obnoxious they're behaving, right? So there are things that we are allowed to do legally which are incommensurate with how we've come to think of these animals.
I've always had problems with being referred to as a dog owner. I have the same problem when people call me my dog's daddy. I don't like that either.
Yeah.
I just bother.
What do you like?
I like companion, friend, companion.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, my dog is fine. but
yes.
because they are, it seems to me to reduce it anything else, because the dog is so special and is so cool that I don't know why you need to call it anything else than, you know, this is my buddy, my dog.
And the dog. I really call my dogs my dogs, and I am their person, right?
Yeah,
like sort of a mutual ownership. Now, the law does say it's an ownership relationship, except for in a few cities where they've changed it to guardianship, which is an interesting turn of phrase, too. But I prefer just, you know, they're my dogs, and I'm their person.
Yeah. And so that is, as you, the subtitle of the book is The Story of a Singular Bond. That bond is something I find fascinating. So I'm having a crisis in my house, and hopefully you can help me with this, Alexandra.
Hmm.
My dog's 7 years old, will soon be eight, and we're thinking, oh, well, maybe now's the time to get a puppy. Now, mm-hmm. we always think about this because we lost a dog at seven, and then you're without a dog, and that's awful. That's just horrible. So maybe we'll get a puppy, and then, as our vet said, then your older dog could be a more of a mentor to the puppy, and then and because if the dog gets older, then the puppy could torment the older dog, and you don't want that either. So now would be a good time. Okay, that's all fine. I'm glad we got the okay from the vet. I got the okay from my wife. And my problem is I don't know that I want to share the dog.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, I absolutely get it. Yeah, and the dog really doesn't want to share you either.
Probably
so.
Not. I don't know. I don't know what to do. I love this dog so much. I mean, we just have a really good friendship, and I don't. But I love the idea of having a puppy. I love the idea of having that other being around. I love that. But yeah, I just the time that we just spent on the couch, just sort of watching TV and looking at each other and talking to each other. That's very special to me.
Yeah, well, I think at some level it might be, you might think about it as, you know, do people want to have more than one child? You know, sometimes they just want to have that singular relationship with this individual child. And other times they think, maybe I won't lose that. You know, maybe I can still maintain that and also add this other dynamic. And it will take something away, but not everything. You know, you can, when we had our first dog, I think he was kind of our first child. And when a child came along, we realized we had to set special time aside for the dog now, you know, in a way that we didn't before when they were just the ones who were always the subject of our attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, the result of that is that we now make space for both of them, and the relationship isn't diminished, you know, but definitely I'll take that dog out for his own walk, even without the other dog, without the child, and give him that special time, and I think he relishes that.
You talk a lot about in here about, because a lot of people want to know, does the dog love me? And I guess I don't know, this probably tells too much about me, but, you know, I just wonder whether anybody does, but that's okay. But more of what I think of is the dog happy? That's what I worry about. Is the dog happy? I look at the dog and it's laying on the bed and it's got toys all around, and every once in a while I'll have a nightmare and I'm thinking, oh, now what could he have a nightmare about? What's bad? Like, is the dog happy?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, as long as they're happy each day to do the activities you do with them, you know, everyone has those moments of nightmares, even our pups. Right. You know, we all have imaginations, and it's interesting to imagine that a dog does, but they absolutely do. You know, if they wake up and you're there, though, that's a great assurance.
Do you know what does science tell us that they're thinking or doing at that point?
In dreams, we really have very little information. You know, all of my research is about looking at behavior and making inferences to mind. So you need a behavior. And in dreams, we know their brains are active in the types of ways that our brains are active when we sleep and dream. But they're not doing anything that can tell us about the content of those dreams. I have to imagine that it's similar to ours.
So let me ask you a question. Do you have to go, or can I talk to you for a few more minutes?
Yeah, no, I have a minute.
Okay, well, how many, like, do you have to the top of the hour, or do you have to go?
Well, I think it's confusing. They said, yeah, I have till the top of the hour, I
okay.
think. Yep.
So let me take a break, because I have lots more to talk to you about the book.
Okay.
So let's take a
okay.
quick break. We'll come back, and we'll talk to you. Alexandra Horowitz, the name of the book is Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. We'll be right back. More with Alexandra Horowitz after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion with Alexandra Horowitz, author of the new book, Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. Alexandra is the author of three previous books, Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell, On Looking, and Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. She is Senior Research Fellow and Head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University, and the new book, Our Dogs, Ourselves. So I want to ask you a little bit more about the book itself. You talk a lot in here about the pet industry. When did this start to become an industry, and has it gotten out of hand?
There are ways, given that we spend billions of dollars on products for our pets, that we could say it's gotten out of hand, or at least it's a surprisingly large amount of our economy. It began about 120 years ago, the turn of the 20th century, when pet breeding, pure breeding, the dog fancy, became a new habit and was really on the upswing. Before the late 19th century, there weren't as many people living with dogs in their homes. And this whole idea of having a purebred dog, a pedigreed dog, just emerged at that time. And so with that was a growth of all sorts of people who wanted to treat their dogs, you know, to the best products, to the best beds, to the best collars, who wanted to feed them a special food. You know, in the mid-19th century, people just fed their dogs kind of whatever they had around.
Right.
But then some clever people figured out, a guy named Spratt figured out, hey, you know, we could put this kind of hard biscuit that we give people on ships, on long voyages on ships, called hardtack. We could put that in a bag and call it a dog food. It's kind of a wheat biscuit, and sell it to these people who want the best for their dogs, you know, a special food. And out of that grew a huge pet industry. And out of people saying, like, you know, you can just have a collar. You might want to make like a special velvet collar or a leather collar or one studded with little gems. That became a huge industry of products, and similarly with toys. And there are better and worse examples of all of those objects, but it was really a business opportunity more than it was a necessity at the time.
It is fascinating because obviously there's whole stores and industries and websites and everything else. And the point is, like when it comes to toys, we don't know what would or would not make a dog happy, right? I mean, it's more for us than it is for the dog, I assume.
Well, at some level, you're absolutely right. You know, we're the ones buying them, and so people who are creating toys and products have that in mind. But certainly, you know, dogs vary by individual. There are ones that, insofar as a toy might keep a dog engaged and involved and thinking, or even using their mouth, you know, this organ with which they address the world, but we don't want them to address the world. We don't want them eating our things or biting or chewing random objects they find. The toys can be a really useful element. But the diversity of them is entirely for us and our shopping desires.
You talk in the book about spaying and neutering and your thoughts on this. And I found this part of the book to be fascinating. We're very quick to spay and neuter our dogs, and not just because Bob Barker told us to, but it is often legally required in this country to do that. Your point, though, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that this is a radical surgery, and that it is something that we can, if we can, have a choice over, correct?
Yeah, I think it would be a good idea if we did, if we knew the ramifications of spay neuter before we did it, and if we decided not to, we understood the ramifications of that. And I, you know, those two simple things are somehow not part of ordinary dog ownership or living with dogs these days. You can just get a dog and it's already fixed, so that we don't have to deal with this whole messy animal part of their life. But we also are kind of denying the dog and maybe ourselves from having this like fuller animal experience. So I'm not against the idea of spaying and neutering at all, and I think that's important to convey. What I am interested in is the fact that it's just become so automatic, right? And this was for a very good reason. People wanted to reduce the population of unwanted animals who had to be euthanized. And over the last 40 years, that's why Bob Barker would tell us about this.
Right.
Over the last 40 years, we have really reduced, as a society, the number of unwanted animals. But not to nothing, because spay-neuter is not the only solution. And it also is creating maybe an inadvertent other problem, which is that we're spaying and neutering all of a certain kind of dog, mixed breed dogs typically who come out of shelters in the north part of the U.S., and not dealing with all the other breeding that's allowed to happen. That includes anybody who says there's a breeder who wants to breed dogs to make money. That's allowed. You know, again, go right back to that idea that they're property. We're loath to restrict people's rights to do what they want with their property. So we have this policy which is good-hearted, but applied in this way, it's leading us into a really strange future world with dogs. And it hasn't solved, you know, the problem of overpopulation, because there are still a million animals euthanized, a million dogs euthanized a year in the U.S. So there's got to be another way.
The one thing, my dog is, as I said, seven, and has not been fixed. Now, when we got him, we were told by both the breeder and our vet that if you don't have to, don't do it. I mean, we live on acres and acres, and nobody around, and it was okay. And the idea was that the dog is allowed to properly grow. That you don't tend to, this was from the breeder, that you don't tend to see the issues in the joints and the legs and so forth that you often have when that growth is somewhat stunted by the surgery. I had never heard that before. But what I have noticed, and this is very anecdotal, but what I have noticed with this dog is just, as in comparison to my past dogs, this dog is like healthy as a horse. And now I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not, but it seems interesting to me because the dog seems to be more like a dog. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, there are, of course, your breeder was right, ramifications for taking out the sex organs, because those hormones held in the testes or ovaries are not just about reproductive function. They're about growth. They're about bone growth. They're about muscle mass growth. They're about brain development and memory formation. You know, they are systemically relevant for an animal, including ourselves, right? If we have our reproductive organs removed, you know, our bodies change. So there's good research now to show that there are a lot of obviously inadvertent ill effects to especially early spay neutering of dogs before 6 months of age. But it really varies by breed, you know. And you have to be ready. You know, you say you have acres and acres for your dog to run around and develop. But if you're in a very close space and you're right, not willing to contain your dog, or you're able to support your dog impregnating or being pregnant, you know, you have to consider that that those things are going to result if you don't spay or neuter. So I think what I'd like people to come away with is just a fuller understanding of the possibilities and the repercussions, and so that everyone's making an informed choice as opposed to just being handed a choice, right? I think it's unusual that we get dogs without knowing about their biology, without right knowing about their minds.
We are out of time. I thank you so much for staying over. What a delight to talk to you. I love the book, and I just love talking to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me.